You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. It's a delight to be here, and I'm glad you're here. Some of you are joining us for the very first time tonight, and I want to welcome you aboard and tell you that I'm delighted you're here as well. Lots of folks are in the habit of being here, and I certainly hope you'll get in the habit as well. Well, as I predicted on last night's show, when I made the comments that I made about treatment of heads of state, I predicted that there would be some folks totally, completely incapable of rational thought about that, and they would say, aha, that's politics. What utter, complete, foolish nonsense. But I have received a few emails like that, and some of them surprising in terms of who they've come from. But I just thought I would let you know that it is true that there are people that disagree with me. I know that comes as a shock, but there are people who disagree with me. The statements that I made, I would have made had those shoes been thrown at the president of Iran, whom I consider I described it last night. That's enough of that. But it doesn't matter which head of state they were thrown at. What matters is that that's not the way you treat heads of state. You can't have civil diplomacy if heads of state are going to be attacked every time they visit another country. All right, and that's not politics. Those of you who think it is need to get you some get a plunger for your ear and try to get whatever that is out of your head. All right. Now, there is big news, and it's really recent news. This just came out at 1 hour ago, and this is information coming out of NASA. It's based on NASA research. Recent satellite observations have revealed the largest breach yet seen in the magnetic field that protects Earth from most of the sun's violent blasts. Now, they discovered this actually last summer. We're finding out about it now. The Themis satellite calculated a layer of solar particles to be at least 4,000 miles thick in the outermost part of the Earth's magnetosphere, the largest tear of the protective shield found so far. Now, you may be asking yourself, okay, well, you know, that's interesting, but why is that important? Well, perhaps you could take a look at Mars and see what has happened to Mars since it lost its magnetic shield. Remember the show that I did a few days ago when we talked about some high strangeness going on around our magnetic North Pole? Remember that? I wonder if there's any relationship. I don't know, but I find it to be highly interesting. I also find it to be highly interesting that a lot of information that we do get about strange things such as UFOs a lot of that information, good quality, solid evidence, gets absolutely disregarded and dismissed by people who should know better. My guest this evening is John Ventry. He is the state director for Pennsylvania for MUFON. We're going to talk about some of that in just a moment. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said, my guest is John Ventry, and he was with us not too long ago. And I've invited him to be with us again tonight. He's very graciously accepted, and we're delighted to welcome him back. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Kevin.
What's the weather like where you are?
Well, I'm near Pittsburgh, and it's probably 30 degrees, and you've got like an icy rain coming down right now.
Yeah, the reason I figured there must be some sort of ice involved because we're picking up static on the phone line, and that does happen once the ice starts to form.
Yeah, yeah.
John, before we get into what I really want us to talk about here this evening, I want to highlight, so everyone knows, that the UFO conference that you have coming up in January, it's going to be January the 24th, 2009, at the Bucks County Community College, from 12 p.m. till 5 p.m., admission $15, and you got some great speakers. Tell us who's going to be speaking.
Well, myself. I'll be speaking, and then we'll also have Bill Burns from UFO Hunters will be there to speak. And a special guest, we have Dr. David Jacobs, who's going to talk about the alien hybrid program and his work with regressive hypnosis. And he's a very interesting speaker. And those are the three speakers. And then we're going to have witnesses, from the 2008 UFO waves that went across Pennsylvania. They're going to get up and tell their story. Some of the people that was in the Discovery Channel show a couple of weeks ago, UFOs over Earth, in Bucks County Flap, are going to be there, and other people can raise their hand and tell their story as to what happened this past summer.
Outstanding. Sounds like you've got a good program lined up and something that would really, really be worth the very small price of admission. And so anyone that's in that area needs to get in touch with you. The link is on my website, folks, right beside John's picture. You'll see a link. If you click that, it'll take you over to his website, and information about that conference is on that first page that will open up. All right, John, you know, last time we talked a whole lot about being a MUFON director, and we talked about some of the really incredible, amazing sightings that have been reported to your MUFON chapter and that you've been involved in investigating. Now, we only mentioned, you mentioned, that you are security director for a large corporation. And I was looking at your website after that and just going through the website, looking at things, and I saw where you have a statement that you are the security director for the 12th largest corporation on the planet. And you have been involved in criminal investigations and gathering of evidence that has been used in court to prosecute people for crimes. And you found, your statement says that you find it amazing that evidence of just as good a quality having to do with UFOs gets just dismissed by the court of the media and government disinformation. And I hope you don't mind, but I use that as a quote beside your picture on my site tonight. you and I are somewhat, we have somewhat the same background. I'm an ex-cop, and we have dealt with the investigations and the gathering of evidence and the things that you have to do in order to get that evidence into court and have it accepted by the court. And when I think about all of that, and I think about how you could do the same thing with UFO evidence, and it just gets dismissed as if it's nothing. What's the deal with that? Why do you think that happens?
Well, you know, it's amazing that there's a total double standard. And the example I give, you know, when I do my conferences, is I point at somebody in the audience and I say, if you three people saw that guy grab that woman's purse and steal the purse and take off with it, and you report it to the police, they arrest him, they don't recover the purse, so you have no physical evidence. You go to court, testify, well, you three testify, then I point to 12 other people and say, you're the jury. I got news for you. That guy's going to get convicted based on the eyewitness testimony of them three corroborating each other, and those 12 people are going to convict him. Now, the 15 of them walk out. Obviously, the one guy goes to jail. But the 15 of them walk out, go outside, look up, see a UFO, and they're going to get laughed at. Now, how come the basis of our criminal justice system, eyewitness testimony, which some people say is not reliable, but yet it could be corroborated by others, and you probably got, I don't know how many people in prison based on eyewitness testimony only, but yet when it comes to UFOs, the same credible people who just testified in court, they're laughed at and not believed when they said they saw something in the sky. And I don't understand it. It's a total double standard.
Well, I hope this evening to blow the lid off of that double standard. I am one of the least politically correct individuals when it comes to. Let me put it this way: I don't try to spare anybody's feelings. Don't care if they get offended whenever I expose stupidity. And so I'm going to attempt to do that this evening. When we talk about evidence, there are basically only five types of evidence. There's witness testimony. There's photographic or video evidence. There's forensic evidence. That would be like if you leave your fingerprints or blood splatters or just one strand of your hair. Anything like that would be forensic evidence. There can be documentary evidence, and then there's expert testimony. Okay, now have I left anything out, or is there anything else that we should put in that list?
No, and you know what's funny when you just mention that? If you look at the valet system of UFO identifications, there's five of them, right? Close encounters, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, mm-hmm. pretty much falls in line with the same five you just mentioned.
Doesn't it? It really does. Very observant. All right, now let's take each one of these and talk about these just for a moment. And I want to start with what a lot of times is considered to be the weakest possible evidence, witness testimony. Now, I don't consider that to be weak because as a police officer, I only one time actually saw the crime in progress taking place, okay? I drove up at midnight, wanted a cup of coffee, drove up in front of a Circle K store, and through the front glass, saw an armed robbery happening. So in that case, I am the witness, but all the other times, someone calls the sheriff's office or the police department, and they say, someone did this or that to me, and I need help. And then a police officer or a sheriff's deputy gets dispatched. They get out there, and what do? Well, they take testimony from the complainant, from the person who called. They look for forensic evidence. They look for instance, if this was a fight, they look for bruises, they look for cuts, they look for blood, for any kind of signs of a fight. And then they say, the police officer will always ask, was there anyone else here? Well, yeah, you know, my sister was in the back room here. She heard everything. She didn't even see it. She heard it. Okay. So at that point, what do? Well, you interview that person who's an ear witness, not even an eyewitness. But you get their testimony. And based on the testimonies, I have enough to make an arrest. And I got two people who positively identify this individual and who state what he did. I can arrest him. Any problem with that so far?
No, sounds fine.
All right, now, whenever you gave an excellent example when you said those 15 people could walk outside, look up and see a UFO. They've just been in court. Their testimonies of three of them have been accepted by the court and were believed by the jury. Those same people, the jury and the three witnesses, walk outside, see a UFO. They want to report it, and all of a sudden it's ha, 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 he, he, he. Or maybe they were having a mass hallucination. All right, now let's talk about photographic evidence. As director of MUFON, do you ever receive photographs that people have taken of their sightings?
Yeah, I'd say probably 10% have photos attached to it.
Whenever you try to present photographic evidence, John, what is it that the skeptics normally will say?
Well, they'll say that it's a lens flare, you know, something that's a reflection off your lens, dust or moisture, and that's what you picked up was a lens flare. Or, you know, if you hold the shutter down too long and shake a little bit, you can drag a point of light and make it look like something else. Or, you know, it's a all-out hoax where somebody just cut and paste and falsified a picture.
What happens when you have something like Stephenville, Texas, where you have multiple people who got videos and photographs, or the Phoenix Lights, where there are multiple videos and photographs? It's a little harder for them to say that then, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, usually they'll just not tell the truth. Like, you know, we didn't have any F-16s in the air. Oh, yeah, we did, and there were only three, but yet everybody saw nine. You know, They don't seem to have to tell the truth.
One of the things we hear a lot about from the skeptics has to do with, they'll say, well, you know, in these days when you've got so many, I mean, you've got Photoshop and you've got CGI and all of this. Is anybody can make a film. All right, I'm going to come back to each one of these. Now, forensic evidence, we don't get a lot of forensic evidence out of UFO sightings, do we?
No, but if you remember the case that I had in Bucks County, we did that lab test, and hopefully the viewers saw the show that was on Discovery Channel. But we took samples from the tree because Denise, the witness, said that these metallic sprinkles came down, landed on the tree. Kind of, she thought they were maybe taking samples, and then they went back up. But in that case, and you're right, we don't get a lot of physical evidence. In that case, we cut the branches, the leaves, sent it off to two labs, and we got reports back that something unusual happened with those leaves. So, you know, in that case, we got some real good forensic evidence.
Yeah, and this is an important point. We do get forensic evidence. It's just not as often as photographic or even witness testimony. So the forensic evidence happens less often, but it does happen.
Probably 1% of the time.
Well, I wonder if it would be an amazing thing to our audience, because we live in the days of, about 14 different CSI shows that are on television, and people think it's really like that in the real world. I wonder if it would be surprising to them to know that forensic evidence is not gathered at every crime scene and is not even available at every crime scene and happens less often than witness testimony.
Yeah. And you know, one of the problems we run up against is that, you know, we're a volunteer organization and there's no budget.
Mm-hmm.
And to thoroughly investigate every one of these cases, like I'll have 250, 300 cases this year just in Pennsylvania, it takes a lot of time and it takes money, and we do this on our own. If you're going to send this off to labs and have people analyze it, you can only pick your best cases to do that with, because there's no money to pay them, or you pocket out some money, but you can't keep doing that. You know, what really has to happen is, you know, the Air Force or NASA, along with the Mutual UFO Network, we do a joint investigation where they foot the bill, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're getting real investigation with us to hold them accountable to tell the truth.
All right. Along those lines, let me say to all of our listeners and to all of the folks who are watching us on internet television, the same thing is true of your local police department. They do not send everything to the lab like you see on television because they can't afford it. They do not, absolutely do not send everything to the lab on every case because they can't afford it. And so they have to pick and choose as well. And many times, if they think they've got a strong enough case based on witness testimony, if they've got a strong enough case, they may not send anything to the lab. Depends on what kind of case it is. They may send nothing to the lab. It's possible, John, and you know this, it's possible to get a fingerprint off of a pair of jeans. But to do it, you've got to send it to the FBI, and they have to put it in their lab and use their very special lasers that lift that. But it can be done. Who can afford to do all that? All right, so
I saw just with this investigation, we had the Discovery Channel's budget to help us, and we focused in on two witnesses, and it was amazing how much we found by having them pay for some lab tests, video evidence, etc. But you can't do that on every case.
That's true. That's true. But the point I'm making here is that even your local police department, it's folks, believe me, I've spent years as a cop. Believe me, it's nothing like what you see on television. And your local police department, they also do not have unlimited budgets, and they have to pick and choose what goes to the lab. And even when you send it to the lab, you get very pedestrian results normally. The lab very often is, they come back with something that's inconclusive. Very often. It's not like what you see on CSI. All right, now, I mean, just remember, CSI is for entertainment, okay? But the real world, it doesn't work like that. They're good, but they're just not quite as good as what you see on TV. All right, now let's talk about documentary evidence. There's this big thing going on now with the investment guy, Madoff, and he apparently ran some sort of a Ponzi scheme and cheated people out of $50 billion. All right, now, 100% of the prosecution against him is going to be documentary, because it's a financial crime. It will all be documentary evidence. And yet when it comes to UFOs, if we have documents that have been released by the FBI and by the CIA that are talking about disks that are talking about saucer-shaped craft. They're talking about unidentified objects, unidentified aerial phenomena, and things like that. These get discounted and ignored, and yet they are official documents. All right, look, we have to take a break. When we come back, I'll pick up with the documents. And then, before this is over, I'm going to propose a way to blow the lid off of this. I don't know if it'll work, but I think it will. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is John Ventry. John, we're talking about documentary evidence. Documents can become excessively important in any investigation. Documents provide information about dates, times, meetings, what was discussed, etc., and a host of other things. All right, now I want to sort of tie this together. And I want to ask you a question because of your background in these types of, or in investigations where these types of evidence are used. Now, this is purely hypothetical, but let's say that by whatever means it comes to your attention that there is an employee of your corporation that is possibly taking secret information, proprietary information out of the corporation and maybe furnishing that to the competition. And I don't even know what corporation you're with. That's not important. But proprietary information, and it's being possibly taken out and sold. And so this employee works in certain secured areas. He's got an access card, and this access card only allows him into the areas where he needs to be. It doesn't allow him into other areas where he doesn't need to be. And so, you set up surveillance on this guy, and you're keyed in with your surveillance cameras, your security cameras, you're recording. Every time he comes through the door, his card is used. Whether he's coming in or going out, his card is used. And that's logged into the computer's database. And so you're watching, and you've got other security personnel that are watching those monitors. And finally, it gets to the point where you think you've got enough evidence to confront the individual as he comes out a door, and you ask him if you can look in his briefcase. And sure enough, you find he's taking proprietary information out. Now, assuming that all of this is criminal, let's just talk about it being a criminal case. What we have is photographic evidence, the videos. We have testimony. And the testimony would be the testimonies of those security personnel who were watching the cameras, who were watching the monitors. And you may even have some other witnesses that maybe tipped you off. And so you have their testimony. You have documentary evidence that puts him in the building at the access points at a specific date and time. So far, it's a pretty tight case, is it not?
Yes.
How would you proceed with that, assuming it's a criminal case?
Yeah, the first thing we would do is take him back into an office, and we would interview him, because it's private security. We can ask some questions and not have to give him Miranda. So we would do our interview. We're trained to interview. And then a lot of times we'll get a confession. But even in this case, if I didn't get a confession, based on the photographic evidence, the eyewitness testimony, we would still prosecute him based on what the scenario you just gave.
Okay, now his only defense, his only possible defense, might be to challenge the photographic evidence or challenge some irregularity and impropriety in the conduct of the investigation. He might could challenge the photographic evidence, although it would be foolish, by saying, that's not me. All right? That's just not me. But then you have the you've got the documentary evidence. Here he is on camera, and he's swiping his card through the reader. And at that specific, and you got the dates and times going, you know, the time stamp on the bottom of the video, and you match that to what the database says from the reader, that at that date, at that time, his card is what will swipe through there. So it puts him on screen, even though he may say, well, that's just not me. The other thing that he could challenge in his defense would be some impropriety in the conduct of the investigation. Don't know what it would be, but I mean, you know how defense attorneys go. That may be what they would challenge, that there was some impropriety in the way you conducted the investigation, and therefore somehow you violated his constitutional rights, and try to get the whole thing thrown out of court. It would be very, very questionable whether that could get thrown out of court. Very questionable. You've got a pretty much open and shut case, wouldn't you think?
Yes.
All right, now we have 20 witnesses that see something in the sky. They're not all in one group. They're scattered around the city. Five of those witnesses from different parts of the city either take photographs or video of that thing, whatever that thing is. We get a statement from the airport and a statement from the FAA. They had nothing on radar. We get a statement from the Air Force. Well, we didn't have anybody flying in that area. All right, now, we've got witness testimony. We have maybe some of these witnesses, they didn't take pictures, but they drew a little sketch of what they were seeing. Sometimes people do that. So now we've got some documentary evidence. We've got photographic and video evidence. And we know that all of them are saying it was at approximately the same time on the same date. Now, we have to say approximately because there are minor differences in time as registered from watch to watch to watch. So we'll say 6:30. Somebody else says, no, I think it was 6:35. Someone else says, well, my watch said it was 6:32. So we know that it's the same event. And so we've got documentary evidence, we've got photographic evidence, we have video evidence, we have witness testimony. What's the difference between these two cases?
The only difference is the subject matter. That's the only difference.
There's one more, and it gets called into question in court. And I think everyone listening to the show, everyone watching the show will be aware, because everyone was glued to their television sets during the O.J. Simpson trial, his first trial, the murder trial. And that is, nobody disputed that these people were dead. Nobody disputed that they had been horribly murdered. But what was called into question was the handling of the evidence. And you may remember they really scorched the LAPD for the way they handled the evidence, not according to their manual that tells them how they have to handle the evidence. There was even some question about chain of custody. Now, you're familiar with chain of custody, right?
Yeah.
describe for us, for the audience, what does that mean, chain of custody?
Well, I mean, it's how it's handled, how the evidence has been tagged, how it's been transferred, et cetera. And I think, you know, what you get with us in a lot of cases, you know, we're not, our investigators are not professional investigators in the sense that there could be a question in that area, you know?
Yeah, it's the only weakness that I see in the cases for UFOs, for the evidence, is the chain of custody. Now, chain of custody is just a description of it. I pick up a piece of evidence. I'm the officer, so I log the date, time, the evidence I just picked up, and where did I pick it up. And then I fill out a form where I give this piece of evidence a log number, and I tag it with that log number, and I enter into the log what it is, what the criminal case number is, the file number, where it was picked up, and then my name as the officer that picked it up. The next section of that form is where I list, I'm handing it to you. You're the guy at the laboratory. And I hand it to you. And I list on this chain of custody the date, the time, and who I handed it to at the name of the lab. I sign it, and you sign it. So now we know it went from my hand to your hand. And this becomes documentary evidence in the court case. The chain of evidence is the only place where I see us being a little bit weak in UFO investigations, and it is, as you say, because when it comes to UFOs, everyone is a volunteer. I don't know of anybody that's getting paid to do UFO investigations. So I would be interested in knowing, do you have any ideas of how this could be cured even amongst volunteers?
Well, you know, we do have protocol. We have a manual you have to read. It's a field investigator's manual. And it talks about wearing gloves and tagging evidence and how to tag it, et cetera. So, I mean, we do have guidelines. But, you know, if it's not something that you're doing on a regular basis like you would as a professional police officer, you know, I could see some breakdown there. But, I mean, there is training. But, you know, we have people who might be a pilot, and he's trying now to bag some evidence. That's not what he tends to do in his normal job, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, even professional police officers mess up in gathering of evidence. And, I mean, I'm a certified crime scene technician. I'm certified in a lot of things. But one of the things I'm certified in is I'm a certified crime scene technician. That means I can go process a crime scene like you see done on CSI. Okay? I got to tell you something. I'm not perfect, and I haven't met anyone that is. And no matter how meticulous you may be, you will mess up on some piece of evidence in any crime scene. It's going to happen. And but we seem to sort of discount that fact about the police officer and then magnify that fact about the UFO investigator. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can have a UFO investigator and that's as meticulous in what he's doing as the cop at a crime scene. He's still going to mess up something because he's human. Don't care who he is, there is no such thing as a perfect case. All right, got to take a break, and we'll be back. When we come back, we're going to put some experts on the witness stand. We'll be back. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is John Ventry. John is the state director in Pennsylvania for MUFON, and I think also West Virginia, right, John?
I have two states.
Yeah. All right. So now we've been through the types of evidence, except for we haven't put any experts up on the stand. John, it's my contention, I really want to bounce this off of you, that if you ever had a court case where you had UFO sightings involved, maybe someone was fired from their job because they said they saw a UFO, and the someone in the company said, we don't need people like that around here, and although they didn't give it as their official reason for firing, they fired them, somehow the information leaked out, what was really behind it. Now we're in court. It's always been my contention that if you put experts, scientists, on the stand, you will win your case, because when you put scientists on the stand, let's say you put Dr. Michio Kaku on the stand and you ask these questions. Dr. Kaku, have you ever seen an atom? No. Have you ever seen an electron? No. Have you ever seen a quark? No. Dr. Kaku, do these things actually exist? Well, yes, they do. How do you know? Now, everything he's going to tell you about how they know is based on indirect observation.
Quantum physics.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so let me ask you, how important and what quality of experts exist that would testify that UFOs are real? What quality of the who are they and what quality are the experts? And do you think that there's enough evidence from expert testimony to win the case?
Your best expert, I think, overall, is Stanton Friedman. He's a nuclear physicist, has a great background in scientific community, and when you talk with him, I mean, he knows all his answers. He knows what he's talking about. So probably, I would say, our number one witness would be Stanton Friedman as an expert.
All right, and do you think that his testimony, if it ever got into court, would be enough to put that case over the top?
Yeah, I think he could present a case that would put it over the top.
All right. So in everything that we've talked about so far this evening, really the only chink in the armor would be the chain of custody, the chain of evidence, chain of custody of the evidence.
Right.
How can we talked about this a little bit, but how can we actually fix that?
Well, the thing we do over here in Pennsylvania is we have training classes for our investigators, and it's such a large state that we have to do it in three or four locations, and we go through how to gather evidence, you know, how to control it, how to work gloves, how to bag it, how to tag it, et cetera. So it's really, you know, a matter of training.
Well, then that evidence has either got to be transferred to someone up the chain, or it has to be stored in a secure location. And by secure, it means that only one person has access to it. It's got to be locked up so that only one person has access to it. All right. Now, if I had gathered some evidence, maybe photographic evidence, maybe evidence, maybe a little bit of forensic evidence. I'm a MUFON investigator. I've been out there. I've done my thing that I was trained to do, and I've got some evidence. Now, what do I do with that evidence?
Okay, if it's photographic evidence or video evidence, we have people that can analyze that but you've got to download that information directly off the camera, because the digital cameras, there's a whole page of information that goes along with that. And I've seen them do it, that they can analyze it, and they can tell you exactly the time it was taken, how long you held the shutter down, et cetera. So we have people for that. We also have labs. Professor Levengood, who was in the show that I was involved with, I believe he's in Ohio. We use him. There's Professor Salisbury. We use him also. Nancy Talbot. But we've got a list of people that we use.
So in reality, then, when we talk about UFO investigation, we've already got in place, although maybe not as extensive as what the police department would have available, but we have in place the type of experts and facilities where you can handle the evidence in a way that would be, shall we say, courtable. You could put it into court. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep.
All right. Now, if you were to suggest one thing that you think is the most important thing needed to improve the UFO investigations, what would that be?
We need more. We actually need more awareness out there, more of these agencies that will do this type of work for us, more colleges, et cetera, that will volunteer and do it for us for free. Because we can't pay $300, $500 for these tests. So what we need right now is we just need more awareness and the media to handle it as a real story instead of laughing at it.
Some of them are beginning to handle it as a real story, and some of them are paying the price for doing so. My hat is off to them. And I have the greatest appreciation for them because they are using journalistic integrity. I think we need to say that as both of us with backgrounds in investigation, that we know that there are a great many BS artists out there, and in any investigation.
Right.
I'll tell you what, you know, once, years ago when I was a private investigator, I took a case. It was a civil lawsuit, and the deal was there was a bus, a city bus, that had a minor traffic accident, but there were six people claiming injuries. And we had witnesses that said that at least two of these, and maybe four, had run up and got onto the bus after the accident and started saying they were hurt. They weren't even on the bus when the accident happened. And as it turned out, that was the case. There were four of them that had not even been on the bus, but got onto the bus after the accident. So there are BS artists in everything. And that's true, unfortunately, in the field and world of UFOs as well. How does the investigator go about weeding out the BS artists?
Yeah, well, I tell you, I find this in your questioning, and, you know, in my case, I've been trained in behavioral analysis. You know, I watch the person and listen at the same time, but a lot of times you'll pick something up in what they're saying. I was talking to a woman just this week I was doing a follow-up on a case, and she said to me, oh, yeah, I saw this gray alien, all right? And it was similar to a case I have here in Pittsburgh, and this is out of state. And I said, well, describe it. And she's telling me it has a gray face, gray legs, gray arms. And a few questions later, I said, well, what was it wearing? And she said stockings, a coat, and a hat. Well, I'm saying to myself, you just told me you saw gray legs. Now you're telling me it wore stockings. You say you saw its arms, and now you tell me it wore a coat and it had a hat on. So all you could really see was the face. So you listen for things like that. And you know, you got to be trained and you got to do a number of interviews, and then you pick up on discrepancies in a person's story. And, you know, some of them, about 10% actually, we discard as a hoax or not being a true case.
10%?
Yeah, about 10% of hoaxes.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. Do you ever spend money anywhere for anything?
Absolutely.
All right. Do you use U.S. currency?
Well, I'd say nearly every time I charge it.
Yeah, but when I'm talking about when you spend money, not when you make an do an expense, but when you spend money, are you using U.S. currency?
Yes.
Now, there are billions of dollars of counterfeit money floating around the world. I haven't noticed any of us have stopped using U.S. currency just because there are counterfeits. We don't throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to money. Why do you do it with UFOs? We'll be back, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. In just a bit, I will open the telephone line so you can call in with your questions or comments for John. You know, John, normally when I have someone from MUFON on or from some other organization, we talk about the cases that they're investigating and so forth, but because of your background, I thought it would be really interesting for us to kind of get into the intricacies of how the investigations happen and what their training is. One of the things that we hear a lot from critics is, well, you know, so-and-so is just a farmer, and he's not a trained observer. Well, let's talk about that. Because of your training program, I contend that your people are trained observers and trained investigators. But I want you to describe for us, you've mentioned now your training program a couple of times, but describe for us what that training consists of. I want to be a MUFON investigator. I come to you. You accept me into your program, and now what happens?
What you would do next is you purchase our Field Investigator's Manual. It costs $45. It's a book, and it's about 270 pages, and probably 15 sections in the book talking about different, very scientific, talking about different types of cases and how to handle them. And you learn about astronomy, you know, where the stars are. You learn about aerodynamics with planes and different things in that field. You learn about abduction cases, how to handle different types of cases that come up. And what happens is when you read the manual, there's a 100-question test. You have to get at least an 80. You get 80 out of 100 questions right. I tell you what, it is not an easy test. And, you know, you actually learn a lot. Like you said, when you go through this, it's a very good training. And you learn a lot about this field and how to handle different types of cases. So I agree with you that I say our people are trained, and then we do the follow-up training at least once a year in different parts of the state where we get our investigators together and go through, this is how you bag it, this is how you handle it, these are the questions you ask.
When it comes to UFOs, police officers who are trained observers sometimes get as rattled as the general public. Now, I have in my possession, I think I mentioned this to you before, I have in my possession a tape recording of the radio traffic for the sheriff's office in Monroe, Louisiana. For Christmas Eve, that would be December the 24th, 1992, They had a UFO incident in which there was a very large UFO. Hundreds of people saw it. The sighting went on for 2-3 hours. There were people who saw it land. Deputies went out to where it was allegedly landed to investigate, and before they drove as far as they could, and then the deputy got out and started to walk. His radio quit working before he could get to the thing. It took off. So it was reported. It's in the MUFON database. But here's the point. I know those deputies. I worked with them. I was a deputy there at the time, but I was not involved in all of this. Amazingly, that was the first Christmas Eve I had had off in years. I was home with my family, and so I was not in all of this, but I know these guys, and they were getting as rattled as the general public would, and I personally interviewed some of them afterward, and I'll just tell you one of them very quickly, and then I want your observation on this. This deputy was down at the parish line. Everywhere else in the country calls it county line, but in Louisiana it's parish. And he was delivering a Christmas gift from our sheriff to the sheriff in the parish next to us. And he was down there with the deputy from that other sheriff's office, and they were exchanging the gifts for the sheriffs. When this thing came over them, and he said it was the most amazing thing he had ever seen. And I said, well, were you scared? He said, well, look, I don't know what to tell you. He said, we're standing there looking at it. The next thing I know is it's gone, and me and the other deputy are down on the ground on our knees hugging each other. I said, hugging each other? And he said, yeah. I said, were you afraid? He said, yeah.
Happy to be alive.
And he said they have no memory, neither one of them had any memory of huddling together like that. It's as if they just woke up suddenly, and there they were. Now, and I have to say, I don't know about the other deputy, but this one is the one I worked with was USDA grade A Olympic gold medalist heterosexual. So there wasn't any kind of funny stuff. It was just because of the UFO sighting. All right, now, we forget that airplane pilots, although trained observers, are still human. Police officers, although trained observers, and they may walk into a situation where somebody's shooting a gun, and they're trained to take care of it, and they bravely step up there and take care of business. But when something like this happens, they're still human, and it's unexpected. Do you deal with your people and train your people about how to handle their emotions if they see something?
There is a section in the manual, too, on the emotional side, on psychologists also. And I'm lucky. I've got a real good psychologist located about 10 miles from me, and he's a MUFON member. And I've gotten him involved in a couple of cases here with witnesses. Really, for the investigator, I can't say I've had any investigator say they were shaken, because really none of us have seen anything. You know, we go by what we're being told. But I've gotten the psychologist involved with some witnesses that need some help.
Well, I know from the aftermath of this that there were some people that their reaction was they just thought it was kind of cool. And some people were pretty shaken by it. Some people didn't want to talk about it at all. And I'm talking about deputies within the department where I worked, guys I worked with every day. There were all kinds of reactions to having seen this. And, you know, there was not a police reaction. There were human reactions. I think that, you know, I mentioned the deal about money and counterfeit, and, you know, we don't say, okay, well, look, there's a lot of counterfeit money out there, so I'm just not going to use any U.S. dollars anymore. We don't do that. But that's the sort of thing that gets done with UFOs. That people say, well, there are so many hoaxes, you just can't believe any of them. And you and I have talked about how you sort them out. You mentioned, you know, your training to watch physiological responses. And I'm sure that you use at least one method that I use. Same, I'm sure that there's got to be an intersection in our technique at some point, and I would imagine it would be very much there. And you can tell with a high degree of accuracy by watching, if you know what to watch for, whether a person is telling the truth or not. And do you train your people in that as well, in interviewing people? Do you train them what to watch for?
Yeah, I try to, you know, explain the behavioral analysis. You know, you watch the body when you're asking certain questions and you see the reaction and, you know, when do they cross their arms, you know, when do they get fidgety, and you get a pretty good idea. But I'll be honest with you, unless you're doing those type of interviews like I do at work, it is a hard thing to, like, for example, one of my investigators in Bucks County is a school teacher. And, you know, she's about as far removed from investigations as possible, and I tell her these things. But do I really think, unless she does a lot of interviews, it's a hard thing to pick up on, because most of the time you're listening to what they're saying. You're looking at their face. You're just listening to the words. Watch the body reactions based on certain questions.
All right. As a professional investigator, what degree of accuracy or reliability, I guess is a better word, what degree of reliability would you assign to your group of MUFON investigators? So if you had to say, well, I think they're a certain percentage accurate and reliable, what percentage would you put on that?
I tell you what, I got an excellent group of people here. I'm up to 21 investigators in this state, and I told somebody at work just recently that, you know what, I've got about 15 investigators at work on my job, and I would take these MUFON investigators and put them up against my investigators on the job, and I think my MUFON investigators would win. And we're actually trained on how to do this stuff. So I would say when we do a face-to-face interview as opposed to on the phone, I would say my guys are at least 90% effective in getting it right, you know, as whether this person is telling the truth, whether it's a hoax, and then doing a good investigation.
All right. I want to open up the telephone lines now so that folks can call in. And if you have a question, if you have a comment, maybe you have wondered about how in your state, how you can get involved as a UFO investigator. Here's a guy that can tell you what you need to do. And the telephone number, if you're watching our internet television channel, is now on your screen. For those of you who are listening via radio, the telephone number is 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. And the telephone line is open. Now, if you're outside of the United States or you're outside of Canada, you don't want to make the international long distance call. It'll work if you want to do it, but if you don't want to pay that international long distance fee, just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Scroll down to where you see the little blurb about today's show, and you will see a link that says send a flash message. All right, you have to be outside of the United States or outside of Canada in order for us to read that on the air. But you can communicate with me that way. What sort of screening criteria is used when someone says, okay, I want to be a MUFON investigator? Do you ever turn someone down?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we have turned a couple of people down. I had this one kid, 23-year-old, I guess he's probably a senior in college, and he wanted to join, and, you know, initially he came across real good, and then, you know, the more you talk to him, he starts telling you about some real far-out, whacked-out stuff, and you just, you know, it's like, okay, fine, you know, this one's not going to, you know, you're not going to qualify them, et cetera. But I tell you, most of the people have a, you know, it's a military, a law enforcement, or a pilot's background. I'd say it could be maybe at least 70% of our people.
You know, I think you, in a way, you've touched on something that I think is important to this whole thing about the credibility of UFO investigations, and that is, you were talking about the guy that told you some really whacked out stuff. People who see UFOs are not, just because they see UFOs, they are not in any way out of touch with reality. And so whenever you, you run up on someone who is out of touch with reality, you really have to question whether their reports of UFOs are real. Does that make sense? Maybe I'm not communicating that well. I just think that, I mean, some very normal, stable, feet on the ground people, lots of them, have seen UFOs, including Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, who else? Bunches of folks.
Oh. Yeah, there's been tons of them, and there's even a website out there, a presidential website in UFOs, where you can go on and see what that president said about it and who of importance saw a UFO. But I tell you, even with the case we had here in Pennsylvania, some of our best witnesses came out once we gave the story to the media, and because they felt comfortable at that time while other people are seeing it. And, for example, when this show ran on November 24th on Discovery about Bucks County, the week after that we had, it was 29 cases come in because now people said, yeah, I saw that too, and they felt comfortable coming forward now. But some of the best witnesses came out afterwards.
Let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Well, it's Charles in Albuquerque.
Hi, Charles.
Your legal talk, I guess I got a comment.
Please do.
I think I know why the evidence that will pass in a court of law will not do in the court of public opinion.
Tell me.
I think they're holding it to a higher standard.
Yeah, I think so. Is it okay if I mention what you do?
Sure.
John, our caller here, is a judge.
I'm retired at the moment.
Okay. But, now, if I appear in your court and I present 15 witnesses, let's say I'm the attorney. It's a civil case, and I'm the attorney for the people who say they saw a UFO. I present 15 witnesses. We go through their testimonies, which they've already been deposed. They're, you know, and everybody involved has got copies of this, and so we present their testimonies under oath. Would you, as a judge, accept those testimonies as evidence in court?
Sure.
Okay. We've got five of these people who have photographic evidence. We'll say two of them have still photos, and the others are videos. Now, these people were scattered across Albuquerque. They were not together. Would that, if we could establish the date and time of those photographs, would that strengthen their case?
Sure, assuming we could, each one would testify that they were the one that took the photo, and this is what happened at the time, and establish a basis for it.
Okay. Would you would you expect the other side of the case to dig into whether these had been photoshopped?
I would. They'd want to have looked the background of each witness first and see, number one, if they know how to do Photoshop or if they know anybody who does, you know.
Yeah.
Usual case, they would have deposed these witnesses first, so they would have asked all these questions ahead of time and would already know.
Okay. If they were to bring expert witnesses in to say that these were photoshopped, then it would be acceptable for me to bring the expert witnesses in to say they weren't. How would you, as the judge, decide? You're going to be the decider of fact. How would you decide between these two sets of expert witnesses?
Well, if I'm the finder of fact, I'm looking at the two expert witnesses, and they both say, "Well, I'm an expert," and I say it's A. And the other says, "I'm an expert," and I say it's B. Well, naturally, I'm going to, as a normal person, I'm going to say, "Well, one of them's got to be wrong," and so I'm going to kind of use my own judgment, you might say, as to deciding which one I think is more likely to be right. But I think the question you're looking for is, am I going to decide that in favor of the people who say it's a UFO or the other side? I guess that depends on what you call the burden of proof. I mean, what burden are we going to hold people to? In a criminal case, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. But I think in the case of UFOs, people are holding up to the standard of beyond any doubt at all.
Yeah, what do you think about that, John?
Yeah, I would agree with that, because I was curious what he meant by, you know, holding it to a higher standard. Because I was saying, I don't think they're holding it to a higher standard, but the standard that you just mentioned of beyond any doubt is the standard they're holding it to. So I agree with you. It's held to a much higher standard that maybe can't be obtained.
Charles, let me ask you a question.
You can hang somebody for murder if you can prove they did it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah?
But he still won't believe that it's a UFO unless you prove it beyond any possible doubt.
All right, let me ask you, Charles, let's talk about a murder case. We have no body. We have no forensic evidence to speak of, nothing that really nails it. And yet we know there are murder cases that have gone to court without finding the body, without finding the weapon, without having any forensic evidence that really nails it. And we've seen people get convicted. What are they being convicted on? The testimony of witnesses?
Yeah, circumstantial evidence. The testimony of witnesses and the facts that these witnesses testified to and how the facts interweave with each other and how the facts bring a whole scenario or a whole case together. Even though there may not actually be a body or actually be any physical evidence, sometimes a case of that nature is so compelling, a circumstantial case, that a jury is willing to find that somebody did it beyond what they call a reasonable doubt. Maybe not all possible doubt, but a reasonable doubt.
And yet with UFOs, they're not willing to do that.
No, they're not willing to do that. They want that to be proved beyond any possible doubt before they're willing to believe it.
Now, what if in court the other side has been hammering us and calling into question everything possible and trying to create doubt? What if I presented documentary evidence? Charles, can you hang on through the break?
Sure.
All right. We've got to take a break, folks. When we come back, I'm going to ask the judge about some documentary evidence. We'll be back right after this. right. We are back, and we're talking. I've got two folks on the line, our guest, John Ventry, and Charles from Albuquerque, who is a judge. And when we went away for break, Charles, I was asking this question about documentary evidence. Now, we expect the other side to challenge absolutely everything that I put on in the case. Else, why would you have a case? So they're going to challenge it. They're going to challenge credibility of witnesses and are they trained observers and so forth. One thing I want to ask you, you've heard John talk about his investigators and how they're trained. The other side of the case is challenging and saying these are not trained observers. Would you, in your mind, think that they are trained observers?
Well, yeah, I would say if they testified, they went through the manual and they testified what the manual consisted of, and they would have a copy of it, and they would testify about the test they went through and how difficult it was and so forth, and I think they would probably be able to convince many people that they were trained observers.
Okay, but you're the finder of fact. Would it convince you?
Well, of course, it depends on the particular case, but generally, yes, I would say that that's the sort of thing that would be convincing. Somebody has had training. They've performed in consistent with the training. They've had observations in the past. Perhaps they've been involved in cases before. That sort of thing bolsters their credibility.
Okay. Now, they've challenged everything, and now I present documentary evidence and my point in presenting it is that the United States government itself, the United States Air Force, has admitted that UFOs are real, and they've done so in an official document, which I then enter into evidence. That document is Project Blue Book. Now, Project Blue Book states that there were some 700 cases that they could not identify. Would I make the case with you? Would that get it for you?
The case with me, all right. But, you know, every finder of fact is different. I mean, and I think if we're talking about the jury of public opinion, many people would not make the case for. They would find some possible other explanation. And as long as there is some possible, perhaps even in their mind, no matter how wild, and we're talking swamp gas.
Yeah.
Just anything that they can hang their denial on, they will refuse to believe it. Because I don't think that people's conscious beliefs are necessarily consistent with their true unconscious beliefs. What they profess to believe while awake is different than what they really believe.
Yeah. All right, now one more question. Have you had cases that appeared before you in court where the evidence was rock solid against the defendant? Rock solid. I mean, there's no wiggle room in it, and yet the defendant continues to deny the facts.
Oh, sure.
Does the thought ever go through your head, what, is this guy insane? Is he nuts? Is he stupid? What's wrong with him? He doesn't even have any wiggle room. Why is he denying this in my court?
Yeah, all of the above, you know. And I've ceased trying to peer into people's minds and decide why they're doing what they do. It's just enough for me to follow my role and decide whether they did it.
You know, I'm glad to hear you say that. You've probably heard me say before that as an investigator, I never looked for motive. I didn't even care why. I just looked for, does the evidence point a specific direction at a specific person? And if it does, then you make the arrest. And I quit trying to figure out why. Okay, so
if you've been in this business very long, you realize you're not going to figure out why.
Well, see, that's the thing John talked about. That's the thing I've talked about, and you're talking about it here in criminal cases, the same kind of, I don't know, sort of self-imposed psychosis, I guess.
What is in their mind?
Yeah. All right, and so you've got that out in the court of public opinion where the evidence is in. The debate is truly over as to whether UFOs exist, and you've still got people standing there in the court of public opinion saying, nope, 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 it just can't be. It's not. It doesn't matter what the evidence is.
Hey, I know a few.
Have you got any words of wisdom for us on how we can cure that?
I'm not so sure we can. I mean, I'm thinking, for instance, of my mother, my 85-year-old mother. She's never going to believe in UFOs. I don't care if she sees one. She won't believe in it. It's not in her scheme of life. And set right now, and she's not going to change it.
Well, there you go. I also know people like that. John, I guess you know folks like that.
Yeah, to be honest with you, my mother, my sister, and a husband think I'm crazy. You know, even though I got a great job and great credentials and everything, they don't believe one bit about this UFO thing. And, you know, and I'll be honest with you, when I got involved in this 10, 12 years ago, I didn't know if it was real or not. But the more I've read, the more I've researched, the more I'm convinced it is real. So, you know, you have the right to be a skeptic. That's fine. But don't be an uninformed skeptic, because the more you look into it, you're going to find it's real.
Yeah, I'm kind of in Kevin's camp. It's either real or it's not. If you've seen them, you know they're real.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Charles, it's been fascinating, man. Thanks for the call, and thanks for giving us so much of your time.
Well, as always, thanks for being there.
All right. Have a good evening.
Good night.
All right. Wow, that was interesting, huh? I mean, we're trying to talk about the investigation of this and how to present it in a way where people are going to accept the evidence, and we get a call from a judge. That's cool. Just cool. All right, the telephone lines are open, folks. 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. And if you're outside of the United States, you're outside of Canada, we will be glad to accept from you a flash message, and we've got one. This one is from Nick in Australia. It says, not so long ago, scientists decoded the genome of the duck-billed platypus. The platypus genome was found to have avian, reptilian, mammalian features. It is, in fact, a crossover species. And that is in addition to the fact that it is covered in fur, is warm-blooded, hatches its young out of eggs, and suckles them with milk, has venomous spurs in its feet, and has a bill like a duck. Yep, I understand that. And I think that is in reference to my statements last night that there has never yet been found any trans-species fossils. The duck-billed platypus is a living animal. It's not a fossil. And when you trace back the duck-billed platypus as far as you can go, it goes back to duck-billed platypi. And it doesn't cross over into some other species from whence it came. It is apparently a genetically engineered animal. I think that's what that was in response to. All right. Now, 602-539-9580. If you have always wanted to be a UFO investigator and you didn't know how to get started, here's the guy to talk to. If you have had problems with or difficulty with getting anyone to, you know, believe your evidence is credible, you've got video, you've got you've got photographs, and people are saying that you faked them and you know you didn't, maybe this is someone you could talk to that could point you in the right direction on how you could get your photographs or video verified. 602-539-9580. We've got about 4 minutes until break. And so if you're going to call, you need to call now. Don't wait till we're into the break, okay? Call now. John, what's the biggest problem that you run into as the state director managing all of these investigators? What's the biggest hurdle that you've got to get over in that role? And I'm talking about investigative hurdle.
I tell you, the investigators I have are really good. They get their cases done on time. And I'll be honest, I don't really have a problem with the investigators. I don't have enough agencies to go to that's actually going to analyze all of these photos and give us, you know, the help we need. And there's probably just an awareness shortage that this is real and it should be studied scientifically. Hey, can I just make one comment?
Sure. Please do.
The genetic side, as I was thinking about what you were saying there, that, you know, years ago, I think it was Stalin tried to interbreed apes with humans, trying to make a soldier that was the ultimate soldier, but he couldn't do it because we have 23 chromosomes and apes have 24. But it makes me wonder, when you hear about the alien hybrid program and what Dr. Jacobs is going to talk about at my conference, if they're successful in breeding us with these aliens, how close do we have to be similar to them for that to work? When you can't do it between apes and humans because we don't have the same number of chromosomes. It tells me that we are so close in our genetics to these aliens wherever they're from. Because if it works, it can only work because we share similar DNA. And I think that's a really interesting thought.
Well, I think that is probably the case. And, there is the theory that the reason we are so close to them in our genome, the reason we're so close is because they engineered us. But then I got an excellent question from a guy in Australia one time that said, if these guys engineered us, and then we hear these stories that they're coming back here and getting our DNA because they've got some sort of defect and they need our DNA. What's the deal with that? If they are the ones that engineered us, why do they have a defect that only we can cure?
Well, I think right now in our environment, if you look over the years, male sperm counts are dropping. And it probably has to do with something in our environment, pesticides, who knows what it is. You could see that happening in their environment also. So they're coming back to get, some of the good stock back, based on whatever problems they're having.
Well, since you mentioned that now, there's another possibility. And I'll talk about that when we come back from this break. We'll be on Final Approach when we come back. The telephone line will remain open on the other side of this break for one call. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is John Ventry. The telephone line is open, and if you have a question or a comment, we would love to hear from you at 602-539-9580. And we will take one call in this segment because we are now racing towards a landing. We only have about 10 minutes left. John, you mentioned, you said scientists tell us that, the male population of Earth, the sperm counts are falling, and maybe these aliens are something in their environment has caused them to not, to be sterile. But there's also this possibility, isn't there? right here on Earth, right now, we have people, governments that have instituted seed banks, seed vaults, and they're putting into these vaults the seeds of every kind of plant you can think of. And in case there's some great catastrophe, they'll have something to start over with. What if there is some great catastrophe in the offing that these aliens know about? And since they possibly engineered us, they are coming back and just doing the same thing. Maybe they're just getting a seed bank ready.
I mean, that's the premise of my book, 1221-2012, A Prophecy, that something's going to happen 4 years and 1 week from today. Actually, four years from this Sunday.
4 years from this Sunday. We've only got maybe 7 or 8 minutes here. We talked about your book last time. Just in a nutshell, tell us a little bit about what you think is going to happen.
Well, you know, a lot of people feel there's going to be some change in our evolution. We're going to go to the next level of humanity. But I don't know. My gut feeling is there's going to be an asteroid strike. That's what I believe. And I believe that because when the asteroid Apophis passed by this past April, April 13th, there wasn't one news story covering it. And I think they're afraid to tell the public how close this asteroid passes to Earth. And I just got this gut feeling there's going to be an asteroid strike, and it's going to cause great devastation. It's not going to wipe out the human race, but it may start like Revelations, where a quarter of the population dies. I just got a feeling something bad is going to happen, and it's going to be a catastrophe, an earth-changing type event. And that's what I got in my book.
Yeah, it could be. And on yesterday's show, I mentioned a report that it just came out. The report has to do with a satellite experiment that has the funding has suddenly been yanked by the government. Now, this satellite has been up. It's called the Gravity Probe B, and it's been up for 17 months. And the reason... Well, I don't know that it's the reason, but the data started coming back from this satellite, and it was trying to check and see if Einstein's theory that Earth warps space and time is in fact correct. And instead of verifying that, the data that was coming back showed that our sun is in a binary star system. It's not alone, and that we are moving quite rapidly on a curved pattern through space and accelerating. And when that data started coming back, concomitant with that, the federal funding for this program was yanked. It's over. And I suggested on the show that perhaps... Don't know that there's actually a connection between the data and the cancellation of the funding. Perhaps, however, there is. And it may be because this data may be verifying this whole theory about Nibiru and its being a brown dwarf and its attendant planets on which one of them, it is said by the Sumerians, live the Anunnaki. So maybe the data from this satellite is too close to verifying the existence of the brown dwarf because it shows that we're in a binary star system. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, the only way that they could survive on that planet if it has this, I believe it was, what, a 3,600-year cycle or 6,000 cycle, they have to live underground. They can't be living on the surface of this planet because when it gets out into the solar system, it's 400 degrees minus Fahrenheit, and then it comes close to our sun. And I think that's something that we should be looking at, and maybe instead of spending billions of dollars trying to get off this planet, we should be building, you know, deep underground ways to survive a asteroid strike, et cetera, because I think that's a lot more feasible. And if there's Anunnaki, that's where they got to be living underground. They can't be living on the surface.
Well, not if Nibiru is not a planet. If it's a brown dwarf, and actually there are some writings that talk about this and describe it as what we would call a brown dwarf, it would not be as bright as our sun, but if it's a brown dwarf and there are five planets around it, according to the ancient writings about this, and if one of those planets is habitable and close enough to the brown dwarf, it would be warm enough. That's its sun. Our sun is not its sun. That is. So if Nibiru is the brown dwarf and the Anunnaki live on a planet that orbits Nibiru, then it would be possible, possibly.
I agree with you.
That's one of the theories that's out there, because there are some ancient writings that describe it that way.
Right.
And so the brown dwarf doesn't actually come through our solar system, but its planets do. It passes close enough for us to see it, but some of its planets orbit through here. And if that's the case, and if that's what this satellite seemed to be sort of verifying, then that may be why it got its funding canceled. Having said that, I want everyone who just heard me to understand that's just off the wall speculation. It's just if. So, but I find it very curious that they would cancel the funding for that satellite as soon as it started sending data back that said, hey, guys, we're in a binary star system here.
And you'd have to wonder if how close it passes. There's always those theories about pole shifts, magnetic shifts on this planet. You know what's happened. Does the passing by of that gravitational throw off planet off and maybe cause a pole shift and that disaster in 2012 that may happen?
At the top of the show, I talked about this very interesting information here about our magnetic field having a huge tear in it now, the largest that has ever been recorded. And it did not happen under the conditions they think that they previously thought these things happened. They thought that when our magnetic poles were opposite to the sun's magnetic poles, that's when it happened. Well, it didn't happen that way. It happened when our magnetic North Pole was aligned with the magnetic poles of the sun. So it happened at the opposite conditions that they thought that these things do happen. And it's the biggest tear they've ever seen. And the importance of that is it allows charged particles from the sun to get into the Earth then.
I'd have to wonder if, did anybody mention the HARP system that we're playing around with, where we bounce those microwaves off the ionosphere?
Yeah, nobody did, but I'll tell you what, we've reached the end of the show. I wish we had more time, but we don't. The end of the show is happening. John, stay on the line with me. Man, I appreciate you jumping into this with me tonight, and it's been interesting and fascinating. Different side of UFOs than we normally talk about. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Be back tomorrow night. We're going to be talking with our guest about Atlantis. Until then, so long, everybody.